the Limitless podcast between Jason Halsey. This week I'm talking to Posey Dangerous Thoughts Parker, also known as Kelly J. Keen Minshall.
Feel like all the world is unchained. My bed locked me up, even though I was screaming. They kicked me down till I did not feel no pain.
Hey, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Yes, we're all right. I'm all right.
Yeah, we're all right. We're still surviving in the age of advanced incoherence. Retaining our sanity just barely.
Bizarre. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, well, so before we get into, if we even do manage to get into the meta of it all, I thought it would be good because although I'm familiar with what's been going on for you, people who listen to the podcast won't be. So if you're up for it, I don't know how many times you've had to do this already, but just recounting the sequence of events as they occurred would be a good place to start, I think.
Do you want to start from my police thing or my 2015 peak trans thing?
Yeah, let's start sort of as close to the beginning of the current narrative as we can, just in terms of what was going on for you before the hit shit the flan.
I'm I was a confirmed lefty, yeah, and have voted Labour. I'm 44 now, so I've voted Labour since I was 18. I'm very committed to the whole idea of public services and helping the poor and all the things that Labour stand for and helping the working class. And then the Tories got in over here with they had been in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. Then they got elected and everybody was absolutely, on my side of the political sphere, was absolutely gutted and thought it was the end of days. And I joined this humongous group called Awesome Lefty Women, I think. And I hadn't really encountered too many trans women. I'd done some voluntary stuff for a radio station and encountered one who decided that every time he did a show, he would talk about menstruation, period shame, and the menopause, which I found quite bizarre. And I remember saying to the women, do you think we should tell these two very young women coming in that the person they're talking to is going to be a trans woman? And they looked at me as if I just said, you know, can we kill your parents? And it was, you know, I was quite shocked. And I just put it down to these people being a little too PC, maybe. So then in 2015, I joined this massive group. And it's all women and everyone's lovely. And everyone's talking about politics. And then self-identifying trans women, people who say they're women, who are very clearly autogynephiliac males, join the group and start posting pictures of themselves in soft focus, the sort of thing that in the 1980s you would have proudly seen on any person's wall who had the money to buy profile pictures and a portrait shoot. So it's quite astounding, and these looked like in old money what I would call transvestites. They didn't look like women. They hadn't had surgery, but there was this bizarre soft focus, very fetishy woman face wearing kind of pictures. And I remember saying to one of them, "Are you sure you self-identify as a woman?" And then I was met with absolute vitriolic language from both him and other women about how disgusting I was for even asking, and I must be a transphobe and a bigot, and I was the reason all these people were killing themselves and people like me. And I found myself very, very quickly on the opposite side of the groupthink. And it was peculiar, and it was a huge awakening, really, that has made me now, over the last few years, question everything. Now, what happened to me at that point is I kind of relied on some common sense gatekeeping And then every time I thought, well, that won't happen, you know, that person who's clearly a transvestite won't be able to use women's toilets. And I was like, oh, no, they do. And then I would think, well, they're not going to do it to kids because, you know, once they start getting the kids, then everyone will wake up and stop it. And then, oh, no, no, that happens all the time. And I live in the back of beyond and that happens here. And I just noticed it was everywhere and this huge explosion. One minute we're talking about gender neutral parenting in 2012 as not forcing children to live by stereotypes, which we force onto them. And I was in the Times with my husband talking about how our boys were allowed to have pushchairs and our daughter was allowed cars. So gender neutral really meant taking the harm out of the stereotypes and allowing your kids to be kids. To then trans women, and there was no more transvestite, transsexual, there was just this umbrella term, to, I think today, on the left, you wouldn't be lying to say that they believe actually your gendered brain is more significant than your sexed body. So I started attacking the whole kids thing because I just find it quite abhorrent that we're allowing children of very young ages, not social changes. I don't care if a boy wears a dress, but I do care if they're giving puberty blockers and these kids are ending up with the genitals of an 11-year-old at 17. And I think that's disgusting and I can't believe that we're inflicting such harm on kids. And so I started writing about it and specifically targeting people that targeted kids. So one of those charities is a charity called Mermaids, and the CEO is Susie Green, and when her son was 16, she took him to Thailand. On his birthday, he had his penis and testicles removed, and they tried to make a neo-vagina, which is basically a wound that never heals, and they had to use part of his colon, I think, because his penis was too small, because he'd had puberty blockers from Dr. Spack, I think it is, in America, who's, I use doctor very loosely in that sort of all trusting term. So she'd already flouted UK law by going to see him when her son was 12 and getting puberty blockers. So then he had this surgery, and I wrote about it on Twitter. Over 10 months, I tweeted 6 times directly. I didn't at her, I just used her name or used her title and the charity. And I said it was child abuse. I said that she'd taken her son to Thailand to be castrated. And she took issue with that to the point of reporting me to the police. And the police got in touch with Twitter, who released my details for these horrific crimes of having an opinion. Mm-hmm. And I was interviewed under caution by the West Yorkshire Police, who came down to Wiltshire where I live, which is quite significant in the UK for your listeners. It's like 3 or 4 hours, which in the United Kingdom is a really long way. I know it's not when you live in a vast country, but they stayed overnight and they interviewed me under caution. And then I was told that they weren't going to press charges after about 6 to 8 weeks. And it's actually gone back to the CPS for review because the supposed victim of this horrific crime wasn't very happy. So that's where I am. This is where I am now, really.
It's gone back to the CPS, the Child Protection Services.
Yeah, the Crime Prosecution Service.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. Yeah, that's a funny funny overlap. Right, so she's appealed the dropping the charges. She's trying to press them again, basically.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what was the attitude of the police that were interviewing you? Were they, I mean, obviously they had to act as if they were taking it seriously, but did you get the sense they were really taking it seriously?
I absolutely got the sense they were taking it seriously. I think the hate crime officers, so I got a call in early February from a very, very friendly West Yorkshire cheeky chap policeman. And he was like, oh, you must be very shocked, and I won't do that. I'll spare you my accent. And then he said, he said, oh, you'll be very shocked, but you've been reported to the police. And I assumed it would be one of the many trans activists that I encounter because they do like to phone the police all the time. and they do like to report stuff to Twitter, and you get feminists banned from Twitter for retweeting violent threats. So I thought, oh, it's bound to be one of these many trans activists who's rather sensitive. And they're like, no, it's Susie Green. She's the CEO. He basically was like, I can see your point of view because I've got a 14-year-old son. But she found what you said grossly offensive. And, he was just really friendly. And at the end of the call, he just said, well, if you don't come to the interview, you'll go on the wanted list. And I was so sure that he was on side and friendly that I was like, oh, I'm always wanted. And he's thinking I'm hilarious. Mm-hmm. And he sort of laughed and we got off the phone. And then I contacted a chap called Bill Bailey. No, what's his name? Gosh, that's bad, isn't it? Not Bill Bailey, that's a comedian. Which is rather unfortunate, but I contacted a solicitor who is well known, who fought a really big case on a shaken baby syndrome. He's, and I hate myself for forgetting his name. So I contacted him and he contacted the police. So then the police realized I was taking it seriously. And the whole demeanor of the chap on the second call was really significant. Oh, actually, on the first call, I'd also talked about, he said that there was an officer in his office transitioning male to female. Mm. And I'd said to him, well, does that mean that officer is allowed to search female suspects? And he's like, oh, I don't know. And I said, well, I think that's quite important that you should know whether or not somebody is allowed, as soon as they say they're female, is allowed to search female. And actually in the UK, that is right, that if a policeman, even with a penis, says that he's a trans woman, and it's discrimination for the police force not to allow him to search female suspects. So that's a bit of an aside. So then he said, and if you don't come to the interview, you're wanted. This is on the second call. And I said, what does that mean? Because you have said that twice. And he said, well, what that means is if you're driving and you get pulled over for a faulty light or speeding, we'll arrest you. If you try and leave the country, we'll arrest you. And if it takes us too long, and he said a couple of other things which I don't recall, and if it takes us too long, we'll send local law enforcement to your house to handcuff you and arrest you. And bearing in mind how far away I am, you'll be sitting a really long time in the cells. So real sinister, nasty sort of attitude from him then. Hmm. And then carry on.
Well, I was just going to ask that that's not the case now, presuming that at the moment it's kind of in limbo, so you're not actually wanted now.
Well, I don't know. He basically told my solicitor when they said they weren't pressing charges that they were keeping a very close eye on me. Which I think is, at that time I thought that was almost worse than the ridiculous idea that I've committed a crime. And the crimes they were trying to charge me with were public nuisance, malicious communications, harassment, and with a light dose of hate speech.
So, and that last one, how is that categorised now? what did they help you out to understand, what constitutes hate speech and what doesn't?
Well, no, they don't. It's very woolly, this whole idea. I mean, at the moment in the UK, they're trying to get misogyny as a hate crime. But I don't really know. Like, West Yorkshire themselves has put out a leaflet that says name-calling and gestures is hate speech. Could even be name-calling and gestures. I don't know whether they mean that's some sort of sign language, transphobic sign language, but those things now constitute hate speech. And it clearly says on their leaflet, there doesn't even have to be a crime for you to report it with us.
Oh.
So it's massively at the discretion of whoever wants to screw you, really.
And what about, as you're well aware, all of the slurs that are being hurled by trans activists against women as TERFs, that not only, I think TERF is technically hate speech, really, as far as that goes, as far as it can be technical or not, but that they actually include incitement to violence, which really crosses over a line into, I would say, a reasonable definition of hate speech would be inciting people towards to commit violence to other people. And that's very overt with the anti-TERF stuff. Aren't people reporting these? And if so, what's the response?
Well, I think the response is there is no response. It's not taken seriously. It's it's almost acceptable to see it all over social media, the term TERF, even when you describe and for a start, half the people that don't agree. I mean, I'm in alliance with some right wing Christians. I'm pretty sure that they're not radical feminists.
Right.
So it's not, it's not seen as hate speech at all to tell. It's such a hold of misogyny, I think. And I know that's a word that us feminists like to throw around a lot. But I do really, I'll take your sexist mechanic who thinks I can't find an engine over a lefty dude bro who thinks that I don't know what a woman is any day of the week at the moment. But the TERF thing isn't taken seriously. The fact that there's a concept called cotton ceiling, which is what trans women who call themselves lesbians refer to with the fight to get past the sexual gatekeeping of actual lesbians. So there's a whole thing called the cotton ceiling, which I think in Canada, somebody gave like a workshop at a public library about how to break the cotton ceiling.
And what's it refer to? What's the metaphor there?
Pants and the glass ceiling of women for women. And the pants of a lesbian, the knickers, underwear of a lesbian, is the cotton ceiling for trans women to put their
penises through. Right, they're lesbian penises.
Yeah, yeah. That's where we are, though. People will say that with a straight face.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I'm tempted to go right to how the hell did we get to this point, but I feel as though that's such a big question, and there's all kinds of ways we can go with that, but so I don't want to get there too quickly. Let's talk a little bit more about the changing laws in Britain, and as far as you just YouTubed about now that IDs being given to men who self-identify as trans women even without having surgery and thereby gaining access and all that. And do you know, I mean, Tell us a bit more about that, but also, do you know about, is Britain the early adopter in this regard?
No, there are two countries, I believe, maybe three, none of which have a great record for women. One is Malta, one is Ireland, and
Ireland.
Yeah.
Really?
Wow. But you have to, I think what we, when we talk about it's happened in Ireland already, I think you have to remember that their culture is very, very different. It's just a more straight talking, I'm pretty sure that in Ireland, unlike here, there are not trans women in women's prisons. Whereas in this country, we have a large number of even sex offenders in our women's prisons. And if you bear in mind there are 12,000 men serving time for sex offences in the UK, and there are 80,000 male prisoners in the UK. There are 3,000 female prisoners in total, most for non-sexual and non-violent crime.
Yeah.
So as you put even 10 men into our women's prison population, you massively change the dynamic of that population. So the Soham murderer, Ian Huntley?
Soham. Were there two little girls, that case?
Yeah, he now refers to himself as Nicola, which is the mother of one of those girls, and says that he's a woman.
Oh my God.
So the current law in the UK is that you have to get a gender recognition certificate. The more research I do into this, the more I realise that people are already ignoring the Equality Act anyway. So for many of these trans women, if you're 6'2" and you're built like a rather large bloke, and you want to go into a lady's toilet, there's not many women that are going to have the bravery or the courage to tell you to get out. I mean, I possibly am one of those women, but there won't be very many. And I, you know, I'm 5'1", so I think I'd probably use the fact that I'm tiny to be a bit more gobby, I expect. But so at the moment, you would have to live as, I don't even know what this means, live as whatever the gender you want for 2 years. And I don't think for trans women that means do all the bloody housework and take a pay cut. Right. So you have to live as a woman for 2 years. You have to have a psych to say that you have gender dysphoria. You have to not be married, which I thought was quite interesting. Mm. And if you are married, you can get an interim certificate while you can get your marriage annulled, which is nice. For all those people that get married in good faith, or people that believe in God and get married before God in a church, can just in an instant get their marriage annulled if their husband wants to wear dresses. So that will change, for it just be administrative, and that means that you can get your passport and your birth certificate altered. So you're then legally the opposite sex.
And you were born the opposite sex, even according to the documentation, and yet you haven't had the surgery or anything, even.
No surgery, and this is by the Tories. I mean, I think it's a bit virtue signalling, to be honest, that they've asked for this consultation. But trans has gone mad over here.
And the 2 years living as the opposite gender, I mean, how do they even establish that? You just show a bunch of photos of you in a dress or what?
I think so, but what you can also do, interestingly, if you lived as another gender, say 10 years ago, and you have no evidence of it, you can just get somebody, you can just go and see a doctor who can retrospectively give you a diagnosis of what you used to have.
Hmm. Which probably many doctors would do, because the alternative might be being accused of transphobia, etc., etc.
And they're private, and there's a special list of those that will do it.
Right.
You know, where there's money. But the whole thing is just, it's so nonsensical. It's madness. So what you'll be able to do is you'll be able to just go online, I think, and you'll be able to change your sex. And we do have the Equality Act, which will cover some exceptions. But also in the Gender Recognition Act, you're not allowed to ask somebody for their gender recognition certificate.
Oh.
Well, so it's really, really sewn up very, very well. That there's pretty much anything you do that crosses the path of a trans person is considered transphobic, unless you 100% go along with their delusion.
It seems like it's got a very limited time frame, though, for it to continue, because the way it's going, just any man who wants to cause trouble doesn't even have to have the ID, because he doesn't have to show it, doesn't have to wear a dress, because that'd just be stereotyping, can just commit havoc and say, hey, I'm trans, fuck off. Right? So that doesn't seem like that's going to fly for too long.
Well, I think it will, until something terrible happens. And even then, I've been to meetings. I know the lady called Maria McLachlan. I don't know if you're familiar with her. But she was assaulted by somebody called Tanis Wood.
Yeah.
Tanis Wood, at Speaker's Corner. And in her court case, she got no compensation because a couple of times she forgot to use the she pronoun for the man that punched her in the face.
Right.
So it's what's happened. It's a bit like what happened in the 70s with Pi. And I'm not confusing paedophiles and trans activists here at all. I'm not saying there's an overlap. But the methodology is quite similar, that what you do is you first get people in the structures. So in every women's organisation that's, you know, significant, there is now trans women in those organisations helping to run those organisations. And then it's much more difficult for those organisations to exercise their right to say no to trans women. So in the WI, I don't know who they've got in the WI, but the WI now recognises self-identifying women as women.
Mm.
Fawcett, the Women's Equality Party, they've got a trans activist, sort of trans woman, because actually what I've come across is that trans women, their most important thing is making you submit to their ideology. That over and above anything else they seem to do in their lives is about convincing everybody else to participate in their fetish or in their delusion. I mean, I choose to believe that for men who want to wear women's clothes, I think for most of them it is a fetish.
Mm.
So for girls, I think it's quite different for young women.
Mm.
But then we are different.
Shot my baby with a 45. I hope to feel, I hope to learn. But the minute she left, I lost the sun. And the minute she fell, I was on the run. Started that journey around 25. I hope to heal, I hope to love. But the minute I left, I turned the gun. What's left to burn? 'Cause I got my breakless El Camino, tearing through the desert, rising up like heat waves, looking like distance seas to a fool who wants water. Ain't no blessing for them. Like smoke from the bronze appeared the first vision. Sky went out that day and the lightning hailed the grain, and every word was a roar that beat me to my knees. So I stood upon them, raised my gun on high then.
Well, I mean, you mentioned pie, and that's something I've done a lot of research into. Turns out, you know, it was connections with my own family history. They were champagne socialists, and my grandfather was member of the Fabian Society, and there's a lot of agendas there interwoven together that I would say are in evidence with what's going on now. It can be seen as a continuation of it, but without trying to lay all that out in a single conversation, one of the things with Pi was that one of the overlaps there was that a lot of, I guess, Pi members, not necessarily only Pi members, but pedophiles, were able to gain access to children's care homes by self-identifying as homosexual, because of the, you know, gay liberation was at that point where homophobia, everybody was terrified of being homophobic. They were just given carte blanche essentially to work in care homes simply by self-identifying as homosexuals. And so that, I mean, we've seen the consequences of that to whatever limited degree in what's come out in the last 10 years or so post Jimmy Savile, in terms of just how organized and widespread the pedophile rings were in terms of infiltrating child care homes.
Yeah. It's I do really see so many parallels, but it's what I can't be seen to be doing, I guess, because I am one of the more known activists, is I can't seem to be saying that trans women are, you know, as soon as you talk about Pi and trans women, people think that you're saying they're paedophiles, which I'm really not. But at the same time, I do think if you give children agency over whether or not they're one sex or another, then what else can you give children agency to allow in their lives? Yeah. You know, if a little boy can say, actually, I'm not a boy, I'm a girl, and then we can stunt the growth of his penis at 11, mm-hmm. And we know that that child will never have an erection, never have a libido, never have an orgasm, and I don't mean child, I mean as they progress through their teenage years, that they won't have a normal sexual development, and we can allow a child to make that choice, then why can't we allow a 13-year-old to say yes to sex mm-hmm. with an adult?
Yeah, and not to mention that the other overlap, and of course I acknowledge what you're saying, it's a minefield. Unfortunately, people have not, they're not seeing the deep context, so they're just reacting to the buzzwords, the trigger words, and it's very hard to have a dialogue there anyway. So yeah, you can just trust that my listeners are not those kind of listeners, and I think we'll be all right. I was going to say, as another overlap, was this, I mean, it's a bit famous, so it might be a bit of a false flag or what have you, but this guy, the trucker, who self-identifies as a six-year-old girl, no?
Oh, yes, Stephanie.
Yeah, and I'm sure he's not the only one, and certainly if he is, he's only the first, he's not going to be the last, and so why should we discriminate against him being left alone with other six-year-old girls, you know, because that's what he says he is. So, you know, once you've introduced, to get a bit obvious and Orwellian, that 2 + 2 = 5, that's kind of it, really. Like, you've already got people to jump the shark, so to speak, and start practicing doublethink on a daily basis, at least so far as they're engaged with the trans thing, which I want to get to that as well, how widespread it is. But once they've taken that step, I think that's the crucial step. After that, it's kind of a slippery slope that just keeps on sliding, I think.
Well, and I think I don't know what the LGBT magazine or whatever was. It might have been Autostraddle, may have been Pink News, which is a odious, vile, woman-hating pile of shit. But they talked about why couldn't twins, adult twins, why couldn't they hook up? You know, because there's no chance of two males who happen to be twins, there's no chance of them having babies, so why can't they have sex?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, we've got Pride. So Pride started off as this brilliant protest against the terrible homophobia in this country, and now it's kind of like, this is what I like doing in bed with my boyfriend, would you like to see what I wear? And it's like pornography walking down your street, some of the way some of these people dress and behave in public. And I mean these people as in these people who march with Pride. I don't mean these people as in mm-hmm. homosexual people. But men in particular, I think that a lot of this is like a men's sexual rights movement. And it's really frightening. But you're absolutely right. Stephanie actually lives with his adopted parents, and I think he has sex with both of them.
He has sex with both his parents?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like his adopted parents, because he's six. And I think it's really freaky sinister, this guy. And but he advised the Canadian government. I'm sure he was on some panel of giving evidence to the Canadian government about trans rights, and yeah, I've seen him be interviewed as if he's normal, as if it's poor him, you know. And he sort of says that he drives a snow. I think I might have seen some of it on Louder with Crider actually. How he drives a snow plow.
Yeah,
you know, there's no too many 6-year-olds who do that.
Yeah, so he's alternates between his identities, I guess.
He alternates between something. Yeah, absolutely. He's just him. I feel intuitively that these people are liars. That trans women who say that they really do feel like women are liars. I was at a meeting where I gave a speech on free speech, and a woman told us all about her husband, and he didn't even want to be seen like a woman. He just wanted breasts.
Right.
You know, he didn't. He accepted that he wasn't a woman, was never going to be a woman, but he just really deeply desired his own breasts.
To play with, yeah.
So disgusting, but, you know, it's a funny old, it's a funny thing what people will accept. So we've talked about violence in meetings, and it almost doesn't matter what a trans woman does, they are protected. You know, people will still not think that that person who punched a 60-year-old woman in the face, she will still see him as the ultimate victim, because of the violence. So they'll talk about violent language, and they can meet, they can respond to violent language with actual violence.
Yeah, it's self-defense, right? That's the context that's created. And in fact, that's something I was becoming aware of while researching and writing the series that I'm working on. It's kind of there in the with the DSM-5 and how they changed it from whatever it was, from a disorder to a dysphoria, right? Gender disorder to gender dysphoria, gender identity disorder, and how they were faced with this problem, which is that, I mean, you'll know all this, but just for the listeners, that if something is classified as a disorder, then that stigmatizes it. Like, now you can be accused of hate speech if you talk about some of these people as having a psychological disorder or problem. That's considered hate speech, right? So there's something inherently now associated. It's inherently associated as hate speech if you diagnose someone or if you pathologize them, even though it might be accurate. And so they had this problem, which is they didn't want it to be stigmatized. I'm not making a very clear they here. I'm not necessarily talking about people suffering from gender dysphoria, but let's say the activists and those pushing the agendas. But if it wasn't identified as a disorder, then they wouldn't be able to get a medical treatment on the NHS or on insurance, right? So the way that they squared the circle, essentially, I think it's inferred in the DSM itself, but certainly we can see the general attitude has been created that the real disorder is in society itself, and that gender dysphoria is simply unhappiness because you're an anomaly and the society doesn't tolerate you. You know, the society is prejudiced against you, and therefore, if you can just get the surgery, but even now I guess the surgery is becoming, you know, less and less de rigueur, what have you, but B, we have to diagnose and treat society as the problem, which of course is inherently contradictory, because it's the same society that's creating these laws and providing the solutions. So it doesn't really hold up, but it seems as though it's effective, at least insofar as what we're talking about now, which is that somebody who identifies as trans has this carte blanche whereby anything they do is a survival strategy or self-defense against an inherently pathological society, you know, that's targeting them unjustly.
I watched Christopher Hitchens debate a couple of days ago, and he looks quite young, so I'm going to guess it was about 15 years ago, and he said the trouble with, and he was talking about feminism issues, I think a lot of men like him would assume that much of this is the fault of feminism, because women wanted equality, and then gay rights rode on the back of that equality, and now trans is doing the same. But he said what's going to happen with this world is men are going to get tired of the victimhood of women, and they're going to want a piece of that pie. So I sort of just thought, because I do think there's the fetish, these trans women also have a fetish about the victimhood of women, and they talk about how terrible it is to be misgendered. And I think as a female from about the age of 11, having gone through puberty, I think that most women are public property. And I don't mean that in a victim way, because I'm certainly not one of those. But I mean that it probably doesn't happen so much now I'm 44, but since I've moved, actually, but certainly when I lived in a city, I probably couldn't get through a week without somebody shouting something from somewhere, without a bloke making a comment about how I looked, even when I was with my children, about what they'd like to do to me, shouting from a car, all those things women are quite used to. We have these tiny little things that happen to us all the time. And I think for these entitled men, they stick a dress on and suddenly someone has something to say about it, and they've never been commented on before. So they think I don't think they do think it's a big act of violence, but they seem to want to believe it is. Mm-hmm. It's to be part of the whole kind of thing of being a woman. Like my daughter was watching the Kardashians. She's only 11, and she hasn't seen it much because we talk about how awful it is. But she said, oh, it's really funny, Mummy, because Caitlyn Jenner asked for people to go to the toilet with him. And I said, well, that's because there's a stereotype that women go to the toilet together. Right. So he obviously thought that part of being a woman is going to the toilet with somebody. You know, it's and when people say living as a woman, I mean, I don't know what that means. I certainly don't skip around the kitchen before I make a cup of tea. So I don't really know what living as a woman means.
Well, I think, I mean, I just pre-associating here a bit, but not entirely, because I've looked into this in different ways, but I think probably at least some of it has to do with boys who haven't grown up and are still self-identified with their mother, and they still have this sort of fantasy about their mothers and what it was like, you know, to be a mother or to be their own mother. And so it's like they're living this, because I mean, kids do that, they role play, and the normal healthy role play, I suppose, is, you know, you play daddy because you're going to grow up to be a man and have children and so on and so forth, and that would be considered healthy and just part of a natural development, you know, stage. But certainly a lot of kids do also play mummy, probably more and more these days. I know my brother did, he dressed up in our mother's clothes, and I think cross-dressing is a lot more common than people suspect, actually, based on my own experience. I won't go into it because, you know, this will be a public broadcast. But so I think that, I'm not, like I say, I'm just free-associating now, so I'm not quite sure how it's sort of manifesting as this something that was in the closet and that's coming out of the closet, and then you know, mutating and taking new forms as it emerges, and finding ways that the society is adapting to it, and it's reifying, it's reinforcing it in ways that then make it truly pathological, I'd say. And it's something that's just experimental and playful. Like my brother was, you know, when he was 10, he was... and I was just reminded of this by my sister. He's dead now. He wanted to be identified as a girl when he was 10. He grew his hair long, and he had our sister refer to him as his sister. And you know, within a couple of years, he was having an active sex life with a girl and was madly in love. And you know, he grew up not to be normal. He was. You might have even heard about him, Sebastian Horsey. He was a bit of a celebrity. He was a dandy, and he wore nail polish and a top hat. So he certainly was an extreme character, and I'd say he had his own pathologies that never got resolved. But he didn't, you know, transition to a woman. That was always part of the experimental, you know, journey that he was on. And I mean, it was a self-destructive journey anyway, unfortunately and sadly enough. And I do feel that these kind of things are... tend to be symptoms of some kind of trauma, let's say, just to put it really simply. But and I think an awful lot of them do come to with men anyway, I think they come to down to enmeshment with the mothers that's unhealthy. And I think we're seeing this in the trans movement sort of writ large, with a kind of what's it called, the Munchausen by proxy syndrome, you know, parents who are actually so emotionally invested in their children that they just want to be completely entangled with their lives every step of the way, and even turn them into an extension of themselves.
I think it's a perfect storm with the ease that you can get hold of any type of porn, and I think trans porn is watched a lot by straight men. So I think the perfect storm of loads of porn, a society in which apparently if you say anything remotely illiberal or traditional, you're a rabid right winger and you're close to Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got snowflake generation of children that haven't been told no. Even at my kids' local school, you know, it's all like you get 1 to 5 and you get stickers for sort of breathing right all day, and there's a real lack of investment, work hard and reward. So it, just as an aside, my 9-year-old is a really lovely kid, and we went to a sports day and he was given an award because he cheered people on. And I just, that is what sports day is, surely. I expect him to do that. I expect my children to say please and thank you. I expect them to be polite and gracious. I expect them to do as they're told. And the reward for him cheering people on is cheering people on. It's not, he shouldn't have to get a certificate for being a decent human. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, prior to my kids being like this, there's a whole heap of children, I think for women, for girls who are lesbians, who are maybe gender non-conforming, probably haven't ever had a day where someone says you're beautiful, and they're, you know, they're young lesbians. I mean, where is there for them to fit in our society? They're not going to be, you know, they're not going to be long, swishy hair. They're not interested in boys. They don't want people looking at their breasts because they don't want male attention in any way, shape or form. So for them, it's an easier route just to say that they're trans and they're men after all, and have their breasts cut off and breast bind, which is really, really, you know, we talk about women in Africa who breast iron to avoid rape. So they basically beat the crap out of their breast tissue and it becomes flat. We do it over in our white Western culture with binders. And we talk about those women in Africa, how dreadful it is and how awful it is that those, you know, those women have to do that. But at the same time, we're allowing our kids to do it almost with a pat on the back of how brave we are as parents for accepting it. And that's the Munchausen's bit, isn't it? That's the Munchausen's by proxy, that if I went on the TV tomorrow and I'd let my 11-year-old daughter have breast implants because she wasn't developing quickly enough, I'm pretty sure, and quite rightly, I'd be vilified. If I went on the TV tomorrow and said that she's got puberty blockers so she doesn't develop into a normal healthy girl, I'd be brave and courageous.
Yeah.
It's
a pathology eating itself, because it's the society that's pointing the finger at itself saying, me bad, you know. This society is bad and now we're going to show how good we are, you know, by doing all of these things that are the opposite of what we've done previously.
Yeah.
So, and we were talking about that reward thing with your son. I mean, of course, the dark side of that, and as I think you rightly point out, that's dark in and of itself, essentially, because, well, for the reasons you said. But the other dark side is that there's a punishment. There's a corresponding punishment in the same culture. Like, I think you're not allowed to have best friends now in Britain. Did you hear that one? Best friends are politically incorrect or discriminating. You're discriminating against all the other kids if you have a best friend.
Well, here's one for you. My daughter was bullied out of a school. And on her last day, after 6 months of crying, as soon as we got round the corner, she just burst into tears. And it's a girl bullying. So what girls do to bully is they exclude. And they exclude by kind of little rumours and talking about you. And eventually my daughter had no friends. And so we took her out to school. And on the last day, I just said to the ringleader girl, I just said very politely, could you just leave my daughter alone today? That's all I said. Now, because she'd got away with it for 6 months because the school pandered to her and sort of almost treated my daughter as if she was imagining it, which she wasn't, and I'd seen it repeatedly, So they then, the deputy head teacher phoned me and bellowed at me, actually, that, you know, he was very brave, and he thought he could shout at me, and I was having none of it. Fast forward a year, and I'm in an assembly listening to my son play a piece of music, and I'm distracted because there's two girls who are 10, 11, talking as in a normal conversation. So I then say to these two girls, could you be quiet, please? And then I got a letter from the school to say that my threatening, intimidating, and dreadful behaviour, if it continued, they would ban me from the school premises.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. And they said that those children were visibly shaken, crying and distressed, and felt intimidated by me. And so that's where we are as a country at the moment. We're telling children, and both these girls are not very nice, and I say that quite liberally, but when I'm telling children that whatever they think, they are to believe. And I think that's from the backdrop of we never believed them even when terrible things were happening to them.
Mm.
So I went to see the head and I said, well, what? She said, oh, it's safeguarding policy. And I said, well, without even asking me what had happened. And these girls had massively lied about what I had said. They won't retract it. And it could be, if I do anything like that again, in which they called a behaviour, I could face a criminal fine of £500.
It's incredible. I just feel like I'm on a fiction show satirizing the way that the world's going to be in 50 years if we keep going the way we're going. How did it happen so fast?
I don't know, because in this country, I think, I don't know when you left. When did you leave?
It's a bit complicated because I come and go. So the last time I actually lived there was in London, 2008. So it's 10 years.
So I would say when I recall first learning about newspaper bias, I remember newspapers absolutely hating single mothers and shaming them, and it was disgusting to be a single mother, and everyone felt shameful for being a single mother. And then fast forward to now, and we've gone from shaming, you know, people when it wasn't their fault, to there being no shame.
Mm.
There is no shame to do anything. Anything is not just tolerated, it's blindly accepted. And it's really peculiar. So that school where my daughter was at last year, there was a girl that said she was trans. And they, you know, and she was, her mother proudly announced the puberty blockers starting.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody will say, that's awful. I mean, if I stood in the playground and said, oh, I've given my child some marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
He's 9, I feel it's, you know, he really, really wanted it. He really felt that he should be smoking weed. I don't think I'd get, oh, you're such a great mum.
Or tattoos, for that matter.
Or anything. I mean, just, you know, we sort of decided that children were children, and it's the driving force to get children to transition are men that have transitioned. And what they're trying to say, and I don't believe this is men, actually, and I don't mean to be disparaging because I'm married to a really lovely guy and I've got 3 sons and I've always got on with men, but I don't believe that these men that cross-dress have a vested interest in the lives of children that say they're trans. I think the benefit for those men is that if children can be trans, then anyone can be trans. It can be a born thing. You know, it's more acceptable if we're allowing our kids to do it.
Hmm. Yeah. I think there's quite a few different intersecting agendas there. Aren't there? Because there's also, of course, the medical industry itself.
Yeah.
America
makes something like $830 million a year.
Wow.
And that puberty blocker was also used. There's big scandals about how it was used for men with prostate cancer, and a lot of those men, A, were given it needlessly, and as one doctor made $1.6 million in kickbacks from the Lupron manufacturer. So there's a lot of that dodgy stuff. But these men died of heart failure as a side effect of the drugs they were given that sometimes they didn't even need for the prostate cancer that probably wouldn't have killed them. So it's there's lots about it. There's a lot of response to the prostate cancer use with Lupron. But the kids are given it, and it's not even tested. There is no data to say that it's after 5 years of taking, which is how much, I mean, if you're going to prevent puberty completely, it's going to take 5 years. But there was absolutely no data to say it's reversible. And we even have the Tavistock in London, which is like world renowned and respected. We have a woman called Polly Carmichael on a kids show in this country on CBBC, which is the kind of 11 to 15, slightly older children's channel for the BBC, so state owned, saying that puberty blockers are reversible.
Right.
And it's not true.
Well, Tavistock is one of the pioneers of this. So, I mean, if you start tracing it back, then they were there, not at the beginning, because you can go all the way back to the 1800s actually with something called the Uranium Movement. So it's something that has been seeded, let's say, in our culture quite a long time ago, and that's taken this long to come to fruition, I would say, driven by whatever. I mean, one can speculate an awful lot about that. But yeah, just in the, I'd say just in the last, it's literally the last 10 years, isn't it, really, since 2007, it's like it's, you know, it's come all the way into fruition, and now it's completely visible, and I'd say pretty hard not to see.
So, to be made out of it, though, there's so many organisations making an absolute killing, going diversity training and those sorts of things.
So, what, I mean, one of the things I find myself bumping up against when I just write about it or talk about it is, what's it to you? You know, why are you so interested in this? Why are you so obsessed with it? Kind of responses like that. Do you get those sort of responses?
Oh, God, yeah. I get, oh, you're obsessed with children's genitals. Why are you worried about what genitals someone had? I was in a... because I try and convince people and tell people what's happening everywhere I go, because nobody knows about it. There's loads of people that don't. They sort of think that a trans woman is some meek person who doesn't come out the door because they're so fearful of how the world is going to treat them.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry for them. And I think men especially think that there must be something really wrong for a man to give up his perceived male privilege to put on women's clothes. So yeah, I get that all the time. Why do you care about other people's genitals? And I'm like, well, you know, we do risks, and actually for women, it is very different if that person in a space is not actually a woman. And it's just that fundamental. For me, it's just a fundamental honesty thing, and the fact that we're being coerced, gaslighted, and forced into accepting an ideology that I think is absolute bullshit. I don't believe any of it. I don't believe there are anything. I don't think trans is a thing. I think there are some people that maybe have a mental disorder that makes them think that their body isn't quite right, or they'd be happier when doing something with their body looking like something else. But I don't really believe that you can transition and become anything. That you can't change sex. So I do. I get it all the time, and I get people who are like, oh, I don't want to talk about it. Probably a lot of people think I'm evil, but I think for me, I just think what they're doing to kids is just unbelievably bad, and what these. I don't even get some of them, but this sort of demand that everyone has to accept this ideology is probably makes it me reject it more, because it's being forced upon us.
Yeah. Uh, the end of the first part of my conversation with Kelly. You can find her tweet and more information about her in the show notes, and part two of this conversation will be up next week. If you'd like to support this podcast, keep it going, then you can donate any amount seems suitable in the widget at horticulture.com/limitless. There's a donate to PayPal button there. My book Prisoner of Infinity is still out. If you want to read that, order that and review it, that is also a great help. Thanks, and until next time.